My name is Cameron Sinclair. I'm the co-founder of Architecture for Humanity and of the Open Architecture Network.
I'm Dan Schein, and I'm responsible for a program called 50 by 15, which is enabling half the world with internet access, which is a part of a long-term commitment from my company, which is called AMD.
They make computer stuff.
Computer chips.
So, the name of the talk really is going to be about. I was on a panel last year, and I got into a bit of a debate about the future of technology. And there was a lot of people who were on the panel saying technology is going to destroy us all, and that these new social networks are going to make our young implode. And I think I was at the time the sole voice that said, actually, if you embrace social networks but professionalize them, there's a way that you could really make a difference in people's lives. So we're going to talk about the birth of this network that happened since I was here last year, and then the idea of what technology means from birth, which I think Dan's going to talk about. Quickly talk about my organization. I founded it in 1999 to get architects and designers involved in humanitarian issues around the world. As well as responding to critical need, it's a really unique opportunity to allow architects and designers to donate their time for a limited amount to do something that really makes a difference, not just in the lives of those they're serving, but actually themselves. So it's kind of changing the way we look at our profession. And we focus primarily in areas where the resources and expertise are scarce. Unfortunately, I think we live in an Anderson Cooper world, which means that only thing you hear about are natural disasters. So I think our work gets a lot of attention for the post-tsunami and post-Katrina reconstruction. But we do a lot of work with systemic issues dealing with inner-city poverty, healthcare, education, and so forth. We have 5 people who work on staff full-time. We have 4,650 volunteer designers located in about 104 countries. This is an organization that grew out of just one website, eventually became a network throughout the world of local groups that would meet, work on local issues, and every 2 years we would do a call to arms, kind of an architectural competition to serve a specific need. And they've dealt with transitional housing issues or developing mobile health care in sub-Saharan Africa. So in the last 8 years, we've done about 85 projects under our belt. And this is just a few of them. And we have chapters that are growing up and popping up every day. Actually, tonight, Architecture for Humanity Auckland will be inaugurated. The Facebook chapter started a month ago, and they've already got 670 members. So it's happening very rapidly that these groups are using social network sites and their own websites to communicate and collaborate with each other. Now, you may be scratching your head and wondering, what on earth does architects do in the role of critical need? Well, we're not relief workers, and we're not recovery experts. We're not really designers either. But what we do is we work our professional expertise, we use our professional expertise to help work with communities, to give them the expertise and the technology to leapfrog over failed, outdated technologies, and to kind of create localized solutions. I'm going to show you one example of how we work, and then 2 examples of projects that I think have been problematic and why it led to the Open Architecture Network. So this is a typical project. We're working in a post-tsunami reconstruction. What you see here on the left-hand side underneath is government housing, no windows, no air conditioning, all metal. 5 days after construction, the 200 families deserted this housing. So you know that you failed as an architect when the entire village leaves. And then as a response, 2 NGOs came in and they'd committed to do housing for 25,000 people. They told their donors, they raised money, and then they started building the housing that you see up in the top left. The problem with that is not only is it architecturally unsound, not only is it not permanent solution, but they actually have used asbestos because it was the cheapest material they can find. So people are actually using material that they know is an issue. So what we do is we work with local communities to work within their own architecture, work within their own vernacular, and help generate strong proposals to rebuild. So this is a community center we did. This is a typical design charrette. This is an area where there's 70% illiteracy, so using art and drawing is a big part of the design process. This is an urban planning scenario that we do, and then twice a week we meet. What you'll see here is actually a licensed AIA lead certified architect, two engineers, community leader, and the village. But the nice thing is you can't tell who is who. And that's the part of that community design process, is that people are really engaged in designing their own future, and so that they're empowered not only to grow their community, but they gain ownership over those buildings. And therefore, the maintenance of those buildings is very low. We adopt high standards of construction, but also integrate local culture and religious ceremonies in the construction process. We do skills training, so we start local businesses on the construction, so you know we can start small micro businesses out of reconstruction process, and very rapidly we can build buildings. This is a completely off the grid hybrid solar building that has rainwater catchment system, the first ever toilets in this community ever. Interesting to note that school attendance of girls doubles if you put toilets there. It's really weird, but you know, if you can have a safe sanitary space where there's clean water. And the other thing we do is we don't put any signage on our buildings. And it's kind of a weird thing to say, but you know, what happens is everyone puts signs on their building saying, you know, this is the McDonald's school for tsunami victims. And the people that are in the school, when the school breaks down, they don't maintain it themselves. They say, could you call up Mr. McDonald and tell him to fix his building, right? So there's no ownership. So we really try and find ways of ownership. So that's a very successful project. We've done probably a dozen community centers post-tsunami. But we've also had issues. And one of them is that we work via the web. And that we partner with some very large organizations, such as the UN, to do these community complexes. Interesting to note on this one, Susie Platt, who is the architect on this project, the UN, this is the first time in this era of Sri Lanka that they'd ever had an architect on one of their projects. They were so excited about this, they all moved into one office and gave her own office. And she's used to seeing a sign that says intern, so she's very excited to see the word architect. Setting up community development corporations so people bid on the projects. We keep our projects very real. Community sign-off on construction documents. They're real clients. The moment that you call a client a victim, you begin to victimize them. So we treat them as equal clients in the design process, and they're added. But the problem with Susie is, as you can see by the picture here, she is working in a very remote village and has access to dial-up maybe once a week. And so it's very important that those 2 or 3 hours they get online to transfer information. In the 2 years of doing this project, and it's a very large complex, she managed to email me 19.5 gigabytes of information, right? And this is just one of 85 projects we've got going around the world where, you know, they want to not only share information with each other, but they want to be able to learn from best practices and failed practices. You know, we've been working in Sri Lanka, and what would happen, these NGOs would go out drinking late at night, and 11 o'clock at night after a few of the, you know, local brews, people start admitting the mistakes they've made. And you'll find that all these NGOs made the same mistakes, but they're not sharing that with each other. So it became important to us is how can we create a mechanism of sharing for reconstruction. This one is actually a very successful program. This is a rebuilding we've been doing in Biloxi, funded by Oprah's Angel Network and others. $115,000 homes that exceed FEMA guidelines, integrate disaster mitigation, sustainable practices, both materials and maintenance, because many of these families are on less than $100 a month in discretionary income. And if they want to meet the insurance, they're going to have to either take out loans or they're going to have homes that meet those guidelines so they can get the lower rates. So it's important to do that. We brought down architects to come up with a series of scenarios. The community was involved. We took basically third world development and brought it into the Gulf Coast and was highly successful. And Kate Storr, who will be talking about this about 7:45 on Thursday about the rebuilding process. But again, we worked with these architects. This is an 1,800 square foot house that was built for $107,000. So it's pretty amazing. And it was built pretty rapidly. This is Miss Parker. She's got 6 kids. So when you're talking on the Gulf Coast, you can't just imagine everyone's in a trailer. Now, it was her and 6 kids in a trailer. And so it was very important to collaborate and communicate needs with people on the ground. And this is in the space of 6 weeks that we got this home built, and she's in her home now. Now, we're in the process of building 7 prototypes, all with very different methods of construction, all that meet these guidelines. Why don't we share them with everybody? We're not doing this for financial gain. We're doing it for social gain. So is there a mechanism that we can take proven solutions and share them? So this has been an issue with us, is that over the last 8 years, although we've had critical success, personally, we've been extremely frustrated that we're not even sharing stuff between our organization. And we're one of 450-odd community-based groups globally who are email each other and connect. So just imagine the amount of work that's going on right now. Taking this to a global perspective, you've got about 1 billion people living in abject poverty. This is like under $1 a day. You've got 4 billion people that are in growing and fragile economies. And most of these communities living in slum settlements, when they get discretionary income, they spend it on 3 things. Yes, we can cite alcohol and all sorts of other issues, but I'll admit this, when it's in the hands of the women of the family, it gets spent on 3 things. Education for their kids, healthcare for their family, or improving their living standards. And that includes housing. This is a multi-billion dollar industry that architects aren't even involved in. This is happening from the ground. And there are amazing innovative solutions that are happening from the ground up that, if shared globally, could really create an impact. Now, we've got 1 in 7 people living in either slum settlements, refugee camps, or internally displaced people. In the next 20 years, it's going to be 1 in 3. So the mass globalization that's happening right now is not happening in New York or Detroit or Aspen. I think someone noted that there's more houses than people in Aspen some weeks. But it's happening in the slums of Mumbai and Lagos, Nigeria. Also, an unreported fact is that in our generation, we're going to double the number of physical structures on the planet. And nobody's talking about this in the argument of climate change or of any of the other issues that we're facing. Education. We're not building enough schools for the people that are, you know, happening. So how are we going to build these structures and how are we going to share them? You know, I began thinking back to World War I. Le Corbusier, in response to the housing shortage in France, came up with this phrase, which was, you know, faced with a housing shortage, there's either architecture or revolution, and that revolution can be avoided. Architecture is inevitable. Now we're looking at this as a global perspective. We really need to change the way that we communicate and we share ideas. And, you know, how do we really improve living standards of 5 billion people when we're not sharing proven solutions on a global basis? And if we are, we're doing it from a top-down scenario. It's a first-world solution that's being imposed in a third-world situation, not third-world solutions involved in third-world improvements. So we're going to try and do this with millions of solutions. It's not going to be one architect. It's not going to be Buckminster Fuller. It's going to be millions of designers, both trained professionals and amateurs, homeowners, who are going to come up with these solutions. And that these solutions are going to happen from, as I said, diverse number of stakeholders. They're going to be adaptable based on the local needs. You know, what works in a rural community in Ghana doesn't work in a rural community in Kenya. You have a whole variety of different issues at play, whether it be climatic, whether it be material availability. You need to develop housing solutions that are localized but have the opportunity to be adapted to be globalized. So embracing an open source process has been extremely positive and fruitful in the last couple of years. And so really encouraging embracing that. And then integrating appropriate technologies and sustainable technologies, even if it's somebody on $1 a day. You know, I mean, I know that we're trying to get the celebrities of the world to buy Priuses and put solar panels on their roofs. But if you put, for instance, a solar panel, low-tech solar panel, on every house in the slum in Mumbai, you could generate enough power to run Mumbai. Right, so it's taking the idea of the sustainable argument and shifting it and saying you have a large number of roofs when you have a lot of people. So integrating that so people are actually generating income from having sustainable properties. So about 1.5 years ago, this is where I met Dan, I got a phone call from a group called TED. And they said, you've won the TED Prize. And I said, who's TED and what am I getting? And they said, well, you get, you know, a small amount of money, but you're not allowed to use it. And I said, this is the worst prize I've ever been given in my entire life. You know, it's like getting a cake and then not being allowed to eat it. But it was actually interesting. They said, well, you get one wish to change the world. And the funding that we're going to give you will jumpstart that wish. Not fund it, but just jumpstart this wish. And I said, well, you know, I happened to be in Sri Lanka at the time. And when I'm with communities, I kind of shut everyone else off. I said, I'm not coming to Monterey. I said, you've got to come to Monterey. You've got to speak for 20 minutes and just tell them what you want to do to change the world. So I fly to Monterey, and I have no idea who these people are. And I'm thinking, well, how on earth am I going to make, you know, a difference with a group of people in Monterey? It turns out that they're fairly important people. And from industry-wide leaders, as well as, future and former presidential candidates. So I got on stage and I said, I wanted to create this wish. Our team creates a network that will allow designers to share openly architectural plans for social good, that we could generate not just one school design for rural schools in America, but hundreds, and that they could be adapted to local needs and solutions, even here in the first world. We have a huge education crisis here. How do we build new schools? You know, it's just one instance. So a whole bunch of technology partners came on and said, look, we'll help donate some technology and some brains and some funding, and we'll try and get this thing going. And literally in nine months and a lot of volunteer time, we built it and we launched it. And it's called the Open Architecture Network. And it, the idea is that you can go on there and you can either share and learn about other designs. You can look for designs, and this is extremely, and eventually we're going to tie this in to disaster reporting mechanisms. So for instance, there's flooding in the Solomon Islands. Every project that deals with flooding or deals with island nations will come up, and you can begin to search, because in the first 48 hours, most NGOs make their funding decisions on how to do long-term reconstruction, which is why you ended up with thousands of trailers in Arkansas that couldn't be implemented on the Gulf Coast. Decisions were made way too short and not thinking about the solutions.
One of the most interesting statistics and charts to see is what happens with regard to the number of hits, not only to the Open Architecture Network that Cameron's describing, but also prior to it, Architecture for Humanity. You can literally see the spikes following every disaster, right, as people Google for solutions as they're desperately trying to figure out what to do and how to commit their funds.
In the first 6 days after the tsunami, this laptop received 4,000 emails. And, you know, I was just swamped. I just couldn't respond. And so in my mind, it's like, there's so much need out there. And half of those emails were people who wanted to help. So it's like, if this is happening just on this laptop, we are in serious trouble. So we need to try and find a mechanism where we can really open this up. So originally, we thought this was going to be a repository of good ideas and failed ideas. I wanted this to really have failures. And we're going to be putting up every single, and we still are, putting up every failure that we've done. That I've done, a project that has been a nightmare. Because if we don't share failures, then we don't learn from them. Successes, we can pat each other on the back. So it's important to have that. But in building this, we decided we would make this a project management system, and that there'd also be adopting Creative Commons as a licensing mechanism. And Creative Commons allows the creator to decide what level of copyright control there is on their design or their invention. So for instance, all of our projects are under the Developing Nations license, which means that anyone from the developing nations can download our construction documents and replicate the building for free. That's it, right? How are these people going to pay us? Do we even need the money? But we have regained copyright control here in the West, so that if somebody wants a good, interesting school and they see a design, they would fund that school, we would get money, and that money would help a project in the developing world. So just, and so we built the system so that you can have an inventor, and that a lot of designers can basically take their idea, if it's shared, change it to localized solutions, and then eventually you'll have another layer that come in and they come up with 15 other solutions. And eventually, over a generation, you had 40 iterations of an original design that would work in 40 different scenarios, so that original design could not just impact 1,000 lives, but maybe 1,000,000 lives. So it's the idea of, it's called, you know, we've been calling it about innovation evolution, but it's actually intelligent design if you think about it. It's kind of taking the, somebody else has already patented that phrase, so, you know. But also being a project management system, teams can collaborate online, and they're collaborating right now on projects where they're working, where they can't reach each other, and so you have an engineer who's the best seismic engineer in California working on a project in Pakistan, and they're working in real time and working on projects. File storage, we have 6 terabytes at the moment of file storage, so it's a vast number of storage. You could put up your entire construction documents of all your projects and share them. Of course, a social networking element to this that you can find and share ideas with people and post images and comments and connect with people who have relevant experience to projects that you're working on. So it's professionalized social networking. And so you're saying, I'm looking for an engineer that has experience in Sri Lanka. And then a resources, and we're going to be putting up, the new thing is we're putting up lost and found projects. In 1927, Le Corbusier did low-cost housing. It was never published. In 1959, Alva Aalto did housing for refugees. It was never published. There's all these design gods that we all revere who have never actually got to publish any of their work because it wasn't seen as being high profile, cutting edge. And so taking all these imagined solutions, putting them on there, as well as ones that aren't authored. So you have somebody who works in a, who lives in a slum, who's come up with an interesting housing solution, that should also be on the network, because you can share and adapt those ideas and figure out financial mechanisms that allow them to get those designs. And then, of course, materials, resources, and eventually we're hoping to be able to put every building code on the planet on there so that you have an idea of what it means to build in Denver versus, you know, anywhere else in the world, in New York even. So I've explained what it is, and I'm borrowing a quote from, it's not from Clinton, from James Carville. And it's the content, stupid, right? I know I've explained what this is, but it's really the projects. We launched this on March 8th this year. Already there's 400 projects that have been open sourced using these designs, close to 6,000 registered users. It took our organization 8 years to even get 4,000 designers. So in little as 3 months, it's already grown bigger than us. And it ranges from women's cooperative centers in Senegal to the first semi-detached house in Detroit in 60 years, to housing solutions in Japan. This is an inflatable hemp house, which I think is awesome, to using every sort of shipping container you can imagine, mobile health clinics, peace centers in East Timor. Yeah. Okay, what you happen, this is mid-construction. You grow hemp, you sew it together, and then with a very thin layer of concrete, you put it on the inside and the outside, and you create a papier-mâché type building. They built this building in 24 hours. And then on the corners, they're called life pods. You have the bathroom, the kitchen, and any kind of mechanical unit on it, and then a portal. And you can connect them together. And when this was being reviewed, the comment that the jury said was, this is a great design, and it works, and they built it, but if there was a fire, would anyone leave? I think it was a little facetious, but... I know in Humboldt County, which is around the corner from me, they could really use that design. So peace centers in East Timor. This is in Biloxi. This is a design that was on the Open Architecture Network for a house in Biloxi, Mississippi after Katrina. And guys from Second Life took the designs, downloaded them, imported them into this three-dimensional world, and then collectively, 9 of them built the building in 9 hours. And then afterwards, they started donating money so they could raise enough so that we could build an extra, we bought an extra bit of property for this homeowner so he could build this house. This is all done in a week, right? So, you know, this is a way of, this is something unexpected. We didn't think about this. I know I can probably fast forward. To build this house, this was for Biloxi, it was $115,000.
And how many bedrooms?
This is a 3-bedroom home. But the one I showed earlier was a 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom because it was because of the family type, and it was the same money. What?
Without land.
That's hard construction cost. Well, the first one was $1,800. This one's $1,200. So you should go to the Biloxi talk on Thursday, and they can. So this is a school that was built for $30,000 in Burkina Faso. All the construction documents are. I mean, we've done schools for $5,000. You know, that we raised with hot chocolate sales from high school kids. I mean, it doesn't cost a lot of money to work in around the world. They put the plans on the Open Architecture Network. 6 schools have downloaded the construction documents and are going into the process of building it. It's a beautiful, simple school using local materials. Look at this. This is a real school. It's not a rendering, you know, of $25,000 primary school. $1,500 tsunami safer house, which allows for water to run through the house It's five times the strength of a typical home in Sri Lanka. This is on the reservations. We have a lot of work on the reservations. For some reason, a lot of Native American builders have been adopting this and sharing it with other tribes, which is kind of fascinating. So this is stuff that's just all happening. And so the community is really coming together and just sharing these ideas and saying, well, what can we learn from each other? This came on last night. I was explaining to Dan. This was a medical clinic that's on the back of a camel, and it has a solar panel on it, and it generates enough energy to run the clinic once it arrives in Kenya, and they're in the midst of construction of this. It's crazy. It sounds completely bizarre, but these things are happening. And so while that we talk about the kind of despair of the future, that's just an amazing opportunity. Now, my partner in crime here is going to talk a little bit about our involvement in something we've created called the Open Architecture Challenge, the AMD Open Architecture Challenge. Do you want to jump in?
Sure. No, I'd love to. I'm here both to be censor him and for levity. but again, I met Cameron about a year ago, and a number of things that happen with the TED community is you have the ability of sort of stepping up and helping with parts of the equation. We're very pleased to say that as a company, we're actually hosting the Open Architecture Network, which means that I get regular reports in terms of how the hits are coming and how the traffic is coming, and obviously it's increasing exponentially, and it hasn't slowed or abated in any way, shape, or form. What occurred as a result of our relationship was this notion of how you take this notion of scale and apply it to something where you can actually get very specific and actually grow a portion of what's in the Open Architecture Network to be useful by a lot of people.
Can we swap the mics?
Yeah, should we swap out?
It means I want to make
these. We're recording it for posterity. I can enunciate to the back row. But so basically, the Open Architecture Challenge is a vehicle to help fill the coffers or fill the vessel that the Open Architecture Network represents. This is the world's largest prize, actually, in the field of architecture in any category. And resulted from our collaboration and the notion of creating sustainable design. This is $250,000 for the implementation of technology and community centers within the developing world. And just to sort of help explain that a little bit, I just want to show you just a couple of things. We'll come back to that. So, again, as I described before, I'm responsible for something called 50 by 15, which is enabling half the world with internet access by 2015. And it's primarily in the areas of education and healthcare, basically with the notion that empowering people with the internet is a life-changing experience. At the current rate of growth, we won't get to half the world with internet access until 2030. So it's a question of how you create some acceleration and bring that in. So when you start to look at how to do that, you look around the world and see what's already been done. So this is a very exciting picture that you're looking at right now. The kids in front of it are very proud. This is actually a couple of weeks ago. I was in Rwanda, and this is in a district in southeastern Rwanda at a semi-improved healthcare clinic, AIDS clinic. So the problem is, anybody can probably figure out what the problem is. Anybody that has DirecTV can figure out what the problem is. The dish is pointing at the ground. The dish was donated 4 years ago, and the dish has never been connected to a network, it's never been connected to electricity, and it's always been pointed at the ground, and yet it is a source of immense pride for the people that live in the community. This is an example of a deployment that was not well thought out. It didn't have the entire ecosystem planned, it did not have a roadmap, and it didn't have a sustainability plan. We come across things like this all the time in the things that we do, both in the educational and school environments as well as in healthcare clinics. Just to show one other picture, Cameron's got so many that, and I've got lots, but I'm just going to show two. These two young ladies are live in the town of Santa Teresa in the state of Nayarit. I visited them about 9 months ago. This is a place with no roads, or to say no roads would be unfair. There's one dirt track which gets washed out, which requires approximately 12 hours to traverse. The only way in is by Cessna onto a dirt landing field. That's another story. But these young ladies are in a one-room schoolhouse, and they are looking at us as if we're slightly from Mars.
The adults, however, in the community know exactly what technology is. A number of them have obviously traveled to other parts of Mexico and around the world. I met one who was in a logging community, who had been working in a logging community in Oregon. But these young girls have the opportunity to experience the empowerment of the internet. And we came to talk to them and to talk to the community about what the internet would mean. And instead of giving them multiple choice about the parts of education that would help, we said, what's the internet mean to you? What would be helpful? And the answers are completely surprising, because actually their first three priorities had nothing to do with education. Their native language is called Huichole, and their goal was to actually preserve and extend their native language, as well as to basically sell their goods and their beaded crafts on the internet and make 3 to 4 times the amount that they do with subsidized Mexican government subsidy. The point is that in each of these environments, there are parts of the ecosystem that exist, there are parts that need to be introduced, but the use and model for them is something that you don't know until you're there. When I first met Cameron, I said to him, we want to put our technology in your walls because our company makes low-power technologies to provide internet access. So with all that as context, then the notion is, how do you do that? How do you start people thinking about technology as a part of architecture? So if we look at the flash very quickly,
Let's see if we can do it. This is a
live. This is a live thing. There we go. Yeah, there it is. Okay. So if you look at this and just sort of mouse over it, basically what we've got represented here are all the different elements that it takes to actually deploy technology for any purpose, whether it's for education or healthcare. And basically you've got expertise that's required. You also have the requires, obviously, the devices that you're familiar with, the notion of power that needs to be established. Some things that are less obvious have to do with the financing and microfinancing that comes into play. All these things are there, but the thing that's not highlighted is the building. And we want to change that. We believe that while there are 6 elements that of developing an ecosystem for technology within healthcare and education, there needs to be a 7th, and the 7th is architecture. And that's really the focus of what we've been doing. So if we go back to the slides and talk a little bit about it, the open architecture challenge then is to take the open architecture network that Cameron's already described and to inspire people to develop sustainable designs with technology built in and networking built in and solar power built in, and as Cameron described, in certain situations, even water collection built in. People will submit designs. The finalists are going to be announced in the spring of 2008. We already have significant letters of intent from dozens of some of the most interesting architectural schools in the world for this program. The neat part is that the prize money does not go to the individual, much as Cameron was describing before with some of the other contests and promotions. The prize money goes to build the winning design. So what do we expect to get out of this? It's very simple. The vessels will become full. We're going to get hundreds of sustainable designs in the areas of education and healthcare, telecenters, that include the technology elements built in. All of those designs become open source and through Creative Commons licensing available to anybody to design. As Cameron was showing in some of the pictures of the actual open architecture network, you're now going to have the ability of actually looking at resources for how you deploy technology in architecture. So we're extremely excited about this because it really opens up a whole new era for what we're hoping to do with technology and design. It's something that has never been done before. I've spent the last 2 years with my teams around the world retrofitting technology into existing space. To be able to approach it in this new way, to be able to take from this entire galaxy of designs and be able to pick geosensitive, successful design elements that are designed to be sustainable is something that's just groundbreaking, and we're very excited to be a part of it. The RFP part that you see at the top is especially important. There's actually a process going on right now to find the people in the different parts of the world who are going to sign up to run, maintain, and keep sustainable these centers so that they don't become like the dish that we showed earlier where it's just pointing at the ground. And that's the key. The thing that keeps me awake at night, because we do dozens of deployments around the world each year, you can go to www.50x15.com. It's all open source and available there for you to look at. Everything we do is completely transparent, all the money we spent. But the point is that as we do these things, there's going to be a shift. There's going to be a shift in terms of what we're going to be capable of and what we're going to expect. But in all of the things that we do, I never want to wake up and find out that our stuff is broken and pointing at the ground. And by incorporating architecture as the seventh element, we really hope that we're going to be able to get there.
So I think, you know, part of it is, you know, we're coming from both frustration, and then that is I see lots of failed architecture around the world, and certainly I see a lot of telecenters that are retrofitted. And what retrofitted isn't just like going into somebody's house and putting in a box and thinking it's going to work. These are unclean spaces. They're really hard to install. And although you may have a support mechanism to repair it, it could be 3, 6, 9 months before you actually get somebody on site to repair something that you know is going to fail maybe a year. So people end up not using it. So it's important to come up with these. And we're going to try and do these challenges every 2 years. And this first one I think is important for us because very selfishly, I want there to be a future that we're not looking at slum dwellers, that they have access to the same resources we do. We're going to build this network. So you could literally run an architecture office through the architecture network and just have access. All you need is access to the internet. And so that we're not looking at slum dwellers or people who are poor or living in abject poverty, but I'm looking at future architects, right? They don't have to go to MIT or Harvard and spend $500,000 to get an education, but they can be working within their own communities to help build their own communities. And that we can gather that and share that with other people, I think it's really important. And that we want to begin to do this every 2 years so that in 2 years, I talked briefly about it earlier, that we're just starting this process, but we really want to focus on education, not just in the third world, but in the first world. Is that, you know, there was a couple of sessions earlier in Greenwald where they talked about education. And it was very high power and very top level. But nobody once mentioned the fact that most of our kids are being taught in mobile classrooms, right? The actual physical structure. I always get like really angry in policy sessions when no one talks about why kids aren't creative anymore, why they are not inspired, and why they feel that they're getting a second-rate education. Because they're in a second-rate building. They're in something that FEMA would deploy. I mean, you know, it's so, you know, I'm interested in that maybe in 2 years, and that's something to think about in the future. But right now, I think our focus, as well as the network as a whole, is to figure out the technology. So this is kind of the end of our slideshow, and I think we want to open this up for questions because I ramble on a little too much, and you guys probably know more than I do. He's like big and AMD.
No, that's all right.
But AMD has not been a very good corporate citizen in Austin, Texas, where they built a corporate campus on very environmentally sensitive land against the wishes of the community. Mm-hmm. Now, this land was properly zoned a long time ago, and it's a very complicated issue of why that zone was there. But there was a choice, and yet they're a sponsor of this, yet I do, there are many people who feel that they're not a unique company in the U.S., that they do things in this area, but they don't have a full picture of understanding what's truly going on and how we're affecting our environment, both in micro areas and in macro areas around the world. And so what can your project do to help reverse educate?
Right. Well, I think, you know, I'm going to let you jump in on the aquifer issue. This was a question about kind of corporate involvement and opportunity and responsibility. You know, one thing, the big question people keep asking me is, am I ever going to get into, like, if I could figure out a carbon calculator, I could get tons, billions of dollars, because everybody's trying to do this cap and trade thing right now, and this would be perfect for it, right? I mean, I know that's out there. We've been talking to some people. But, you know, this is the way I look at corporations. I worked for some big ones, too. Let me just say, I always felt I was pushing and needling the company I was working in to go a direction. AMD, Sun Microsystems, Microsoft, they're all giant tankers, right? It's going to be very slow for them to move, but they will move. And what they need is a bunch of tugboats that ram them on the side and push them in a direction. Our organization is a tugboat, right? If this project we do together is successful, it's not only going to be successful for the thousands of people who are going to benefit from this, but for me, it will be personally successful because AMD will be much more willing to expand their operations into this sort of field, even into a first world situation. So selfishly, yes, you know, but if I, you know, I always argue with a lot of my compatriots who are my age that, you know, if they stopped making signs out of wood, they could build houses with them, which, you know, the point of that is this: everyone goes and protests, but, you know, it's easy to protest, right? It's whoever has the loudest voice, but doing the work is hard, and it's and you make more of an impact if you can ram the tanker every so often and steer the ship. Do you mind me talking about you like that?
No, that's fine. I've been described as worse. So in answer to just a little bit, I'll just keep it away. I think you've got me now, right? But in answer to some of the comments about AMD, I think just very briefly, specifically to the issue of the campus in Austin, I would just say that there's a tremendous amount of information available with regard to what's actually happened there, not sponsored by us in terms of what we've done. I've actually visited the Lady Bird Johnson Park, where they've actually taken all of the natural plants and materials that they had to take up from the construction site, and actually it's still all growing, and then they're going to bring it all back. It's got the largest rainwater collection facility in the western United States. The aquifer itself has been considered. But to speak to your larger question in terms of the holistic notion, as the fifth greenest company in Texas, we actually focus on green all the way from the data center, which is basically the computers and servers that run everything, and working with some of the organizations that we helped found called Green Grid to actually half the amount of energy while still maintaining the same amount of processing power all the way there, all the way down to the lowest power devices that are completely battery and solar powered in the environment. In fact, that's a lot of what we've been working on with Cameron is working on the entire ecosystem of how you deploy green and how you use less power. This becomes especially important in places that Cameron and I were just in very recently, like Cape Town, where they dropped a bolt in the number 2 reactor, and all of a sudden they have half of the electricity that they had three years ago. Yeah, in South Africa. And in those environments, they sent thousands of people around changing out light bulbs. What they're now doing, though, is looking at terrible misuses of power that have been occurring throughout the environment, and they're now using some of these green technologies and green both computing technologies as well as new architectural designs to try to make things happen. From a corporate point of view, there's organizations like Nedbank, the fourth largest bank in Africa, that actually did award-winning work with regard to solar panels by actually putting up their billboards and putting solar panels on top. One of the biggest problems you run into with solar is that people recognize, almost like they used to recognize copper as being very valuable and you could sell it. Solar panels are extremely hot commodities. And so one of the biggest questions and one of the biggest concerns we'll have for the Open Architecture Challenge is how do you secure your solar so that it doesn't disappear in the middle of the night? And Nedbank actually put their solar panels, which charge school and kitchens, at the base of these billboards. They put the solar panels on top of the billboards, and without making it sound too morbid, the solar panels actually are self-protecting in terms of making sure that nobody really climbs up and takes them down. We actually look across for our green stuff, all aspects of it, and a number of the other companies that Cameron referred to have also taken that responsibility. I think one of the things that's most distressing to me is I'll come into a school in Uganda, or it's happened in Deep Sloot, actually, also in South Africa, and we'll say, where do you think you might want to put the computers? And people will say, oh, we have the computer lab. And they'll actually find somebody who will find somebody else who will find a key, and they'll open up a dusty room, and there'll be a pile of desktops on the floor that were donated by well-meaning people. But the power consumption of them was so great that they couldn't afford to run them. And when they did run them, the variations in the power would blow them, even with UPS devices. And also the kids, who were very intelligent, would actually go and take out a couple parts so that the technician that would only come by every month would say it's broken, and then they would throw them out the back, and then the kids would put the parts back in, take them home. They wouldn't sell them. They wanted them. They wanted to be able to use them. There's a nonprofit called Invenio that we work very closely with in San Francisco that makes low-power computing devices all in one with a screen and everything else. It draws less than 20 watts. The average desktop takes 200 watts. So you can now run 10 devices
in the power envelope that it used to take to run one. And so with every project that we undertake and in the resources that we're going to be making available on the Open Architecture Network, whether it has to do with the networking, the solar, you know, things like water collection, or the computing itself, the wireless, all of these elements, we are looking at it from a point of low power, low maintenance, and sustainability.
I think the other thing to know, and I'm going to follow up on that, is so that's it's kind of ironic that there's so much green reporting going on right now. I write for World Changing and Habitat, ArConnect. I blog for like three of the biggest, and Tree Hugger, four of the biggest green blogs in the world, right? You could put 50 of us in a room. We represent every blogger that deals with green design, green technology. Somehow, they've become like the recent celebrities, right? And we're dictating, how green conversation is happening. It's very weird to be a part of something that's having this fad, buzz, whatever. And that's very dangerous at the same time. So, you know, when you see a lot of green reporting, it's actually happening just from a bunch of people. Like, that I could probably, I am right now, and tell them, blog whatever you say, and it will go on 25 blogs in 2 minutes. So the power, the shift of conversation is happening. Really kind of interesting that, you know, Time Magazine will call us up and say, please, just give us something we can put in our magazine because we need to be greener. You know, so it's like this green reporting is very weird right now. So,
I'll take no more time than you did when you talked about moving plants and that y'all have done this property very green. I would like to see corporations take a larger view. And in this case, the issue is not the campus. The issue is the secondary growth. And this is true of development all over the world. Mm-hmm. One person puts up a tin shack and suddenly you've got 400,000 people. Outside of Mexico City, there's an area that's, last time I checked, was 3 or 4 million people that had more feces in the air because there was no sewage. The issue of that particular campus, which you didn't say a word about, was the secondary growth. You then have traffic, you have homes that are built because people want to get closer to that. All of this being on environmentally sensitive land, of which there are not the regulations to do the extensive or the dollars to do the extensive so-called green technology that y'all have used to build the campus. And so when you do a project in the world, or when AMD does something, you cannot justify that which you do in one place by something you do over here. It has to be a large picture. And currently in the U.S., like I'll use myself as an example. I'm redoing a home in Austin, Texas. I could afford to do whatever I please. I have chosen to maintain a 1954 home with jalousy windows, which if you don't know what those are, these little tiny windows that leak like a sieve. But if you actually looked at the environmental cost of replacing those windows, that environmental cost includes trucking, it includes aluminum manufacturing, it includes glass manufacturing, it would be 300 years worth of environmental damage before you would replace the cost of energy that those windows are going to consume in air conditioning. You're better to leave them alone. Right. And this is what your project is dealing with. Corporations in America, they may talk green, but until they get that, we are not there.
It's going to take them time, and I think
so
you just...
Oh
yeah. So the conversation was about the secondary effects of corporations going into areas, and even on a global perspective, you know, growth is going to happen no matter what, and we need people still putting pressure on corporations, but as well as developers. I mean, it's not just. I mean, 98% of new housing in America do not use the services of an architect. Right, most of it is being done by the Home Builders Association or whatever. You know, the question, for instance, for large corporations is, what's being sold at Home Depot? Right, it's like there were no SIPS panels available in Mississippi or Louisiana for months, and the only place you could buy materials was Home Depot. And you would, how bad it got is you would go to Home Depot on Sunday morning because they would sell the scraps for 25% of the cost. And there'd be a 6-hour line because families couldn't afford the regular price. So, I mean, and then they were using kind of the cheapest, worst material they could find because they couldn't afford it. So, you know, this is happening on a global basis. And yes, corporations need to kind of take a more holistic approach, but, you know, there's, luckily I don't have an economist brain, so, you know, I don't think I would ever run a corporation. I think it would be Patagonia. So I see two questions. This is about relationship with Habitat for Humanity. Yes, we do. And it was really surprising because we do have similar names and we agreed on our naming issues. But we provide them with architects and it's been really good. We just did Warner Robins in Georgia. It was a $56,000 house for a family of seven. We've been helping them actually a lot internationally. This was an issue where they had beautiful homes in Indonesia, but the contractors on the ground were taking out what they thought was superfluous materials, which happened to be the structural columns. So, you know, we worked a little bit with them there. Another faith-based groups, actually some of the photos you saw, there's over 25 different faith-based groups who worked on those houses. The best, which I still love, are the Amish, who did a lot of the carpentry because we had to drive them around everywhere. It was kind of fun. But yeah, we have a good relationship with them, and we're gonna expand that relationship. Yeah, there was one in the back, and then one in the front, and one here.
On our recent trip between Mississippi and New Orleans, I was with my sister, and I saw this field, I mean, literally acres of FEMA trailers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I said to her, "What are they?" And she says, "Those are FEMA trailers." And we drove, and we drove, and we drove. And it was just, and it was, I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Right.
And then I see what you're showing, mostly in foreign countries, and I'm thinking, so much work, so much humanity, so much intelligence mm-hmm. going into creating these structures in foreign countries, and so much waste sitting in the field on our own. I mean, how do you explain that kind of failure? And
you know, it's
success on the other hand.
You know why? I'll tell you one reason. Oh, failures of the Gulf Coast versus international. America is the most litigious society in the world. You'll get sued for anything. The FEMA people didn't even put ADA ramps because they thought they would get sued. So none of the people who had disabilities could get in their trailers. And if they couldn't inhabit their trailers in a month, they got taken away. So, I mean, we spent a month just building ADA ramps, you know, handicap ramps. So it's just policy. And to be quite honest, FEMA got into a position that they were never supposed to be in. They were never a long-term housing solution organization. They were emergency. And so the people that you would have on the ground, they didn't even have business cards. Right? I mean, you know you're in trouble when the people who are providing you housing don't even have business cards because they're volunteering for 2 weeks and then they're going to go away. Families want long-term commitment. We're in an area for at least 5 years minimum. And then looking at what I didn't talk about is that as well as the seven homes here, we've also helped rehab 400 and some various other things, all by taking what was a $200,000 grant, working out the financing mechanism and growing that to a $6 million community fund. And Kate will talk about that on Thursday. But these policies, I'm taking international development. Billions of dollars get spent on generating development initiatives on a global basis. And we're not willing to accept them here because it's seen as like, well, we're not a third world country. I've been in Mississippi and I've been on the reservations. It's far worse than things you see in Uganda and Kenya. And it's really embarrassing to tell, you know. I mean, it was actually funny. We got these houses built. In less than 24 hours, the governor showed up, right? Because he was like, you know, he was like, what do you mean they're bigger than 400 square feet? You know, and he didn't believe us. So, you know, I think, you know, I have a phrase, put up or shut up. You know, when you're an architect, you either just got to build it or you just got to shut up. There's a lot of talk that happens. And, you know, I think it's important that we have to build these pilots. We have to show they work and figure out the financing mechanism so we can get these families out of FEMA trailers and into long-term homes with equity. And that's the big important thing. Either provide equity or a job, and a family will move from a FEMA trailer. But if you offer them no hope, then they're going to leave. And so, and there's one here. That's one here and one here.
Depending on subsidies and NGOs and et cetera, to be able to finance
Well, all of this is funded through individual donations. So all of our work has been done. We raised a quarter of our funding for the tsunami from high school kids. So, I mean, we're not, you know, we haven't got any government funding since our creation because it's easier to work because policy is so slow. We work within the poverty line of a specific area. In Biloxi, the median income is $27,000, I believe. So, you know, Ms. Parker's on 22. You know, she's got six kids. You understand the need there. You know, just because we do a $5,000 school in Sri Lanka doesn't mean that it's more important than a single-family home in Biloxi. Look at low-income in Aspen. I know it's kind of really weird to say, but is there any low-income housing in Aspen? I mean, you can't even do it in Carbondale. You have to go even further now. So, you know, talking about commute and issues of climate change, I mean, you've got low-income communities that are doing service-based industry within areas. I lived in Bozeman, Montana, and Bozeman has a decision right now. They're either going to become Aspen or they're not. And they know this, and they're talking about this. And they did a 15-year plan to extend the roadways. By the time they completed that construction, the traffic was already too much. So, you know, we really work within specific areas, figure out where the gaps are in the areas of poverty, because you also get a lot of funders who want to help the absolute poor, right? But then there's this group of lower middle income who are actually in more need because nobody is coming to their service.
Can I just clarify I think your Biloxi is about $96 a square foot.
Yeah. We've done a 10-year forgivable loan mechanism that we've worked with the community banks and through Oprah's Angel Network so that it's the first set are fully funded by Oprah. Mm-hmm. So.
But are there efforts to innovate to get down to, my research is about $50 a square foot?
If you get down to $50 a square foot in Biloxi, you start cutting in on the mitigation and these homes will go down. I mean, I can put a $50 a square foot house up in Biloxi tomorrow, but they won't get the insurance. Certainly not from Allstate. If anyone's from Allstate here, they pulled out of Biloxi, so I have a little beep. And the next time there's a storm, that house is not going to be structurally sound. You just cannot do a structurally sound house at that price. And an elevation level of 3 to 9 feet. So most of these homes that we're looking at are 9 feet elevation. So there's a question. There's a couple of this was about involvement of CDCs, community development corporations, utilizing the Open Architecture Network. It is very young. It's a couple of months old. The first one to sign up was Detroit, a lot of community development corporations. They're looking at shrink issues. Detroit is a shrinking city. How do you deal with that? And so it's an interesting mechanism about abandonment of houses. So there's a couple of abandoned houses on there, and how do you repurpose abandoned houses, which is interesting. But we're going out there and actively pursuing involvement of CDCs. And I think they're, you know, we'll see what happens in a year. I mean, we're not going to have the growth of Facebook or MySpace because that's like... Well, that's very little content. I mean, you know, I'm on Facebook and, you know, I put the most banal things on there and people get excited. Yeah. So, like, we're putting up full construction plans. That's pretty serious stuff. So, but the sharing idea, the mechanism of open source, it works a lot more internationally. Again, to the question earlier about America being a litigious society, people get very scared about sharing when they think they're going to get sued. So we've worked a lot with Lawrence Lessig and Creative Commons to create new licensing mechanisms that address that and deal with the liability issues and third-party liability, which is a major issue in the United States, which means I build a house in Biloxi. It's pro bono. We sign an agreement that there's volunteer labor on it. The homeowner then sells it to somebody else, and then something goes wrong. And they go back and suing the homeowner and suing the people who constructed it, and then they're suing some high schooler who volunteered on some house, right? That happens. That actually happens. So you've got to figure out protecting the homeowner as well as the construction of these projects.
I think Caramon almost glossed over it, that the work that they've done with Creative Commons is literally creating new categories of licensing that have never been approached before, even beyond traditional. And it just, it's really pretty astounding what they've come up with.
Yeah, it's actually, I learned about Creative Commons not because we approached them. It's because we started adopting Creative Commons as a licensing mechanism in South Africa, and Lawrence Lessig, who helped found Creative Commons, he got so excited about it, he did a whole lecture about it somewhere in Berlin or something, and it ended up on the internet. And I read about it, and it had everything about our organization and what we'd been doing, and I was like, wait a minute. So we should work together. So we've been.
I know actually, you had a question. Sir, yeah, I think you were next, I believe.
Talk about sharing. Have you had any interaction with C.K. Prahalad? We'll be speaking here later this week.
You know, we keep meeting into each other, and I don't think I've really kind of, he's talked to me, I haven't talked to him, if you know what that means.
I hope you get the chance. Yeah. I won't get into it here, but we can talk about it later. You've got a lot in common, and
right.
He's got a lot of great connections. Second was, have you had any interaction with, now that the MIT so-called $100 laptop is available at $150,
right.
Have you been working with them in any way to get
AMD's pretty much involved heavily.
So we're the technology inside. So we're on the board, and so we are pretty involved. And in fact, a number of the projects that we're looking at for later this year. In fact, the sort of production is going to be shipping in Q3. So we're nailing it. We're in Q3.
I played with one 2 weeks ago, and I'm very impressed.
I'm glad it was 2 weeks ago, not the beginning of January, because it's extraordinary how far it's come. You're absolutely right.
Just one comment about the one laptop child, which I've told Negroponte again and again. I want to take one of the machines and hack it, right? I want to get a bunch of hackers to basically strip out the education and turn it into a tool for innovation and put on SketchUp, right? Google SketchUp, which is free, and so that they can develop housing ideas and then put it on the Open Architecture Network. So
the third point was, I came a couple minutes late. Did you happen to talk about Field of Dreams before I got here?
Oh, no.
It's a charming story.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, very briefly, we're doing a project. It's a soccer field for young women in South Africa, and it doubles as a HIV/AIDS outreach center. It provides not just healthcare for these young women for the first time ever, but it's the first ever soccer league for girls in KwaZulu-Natal. And we literally just put a sign on a wall saying, sign on a tree that said, who wants to join a girls' soccer league? And within a week, we had 600 girls. And we developed designs, and we're now working with a couple of different groups, and we won a big award for it, the Index Award. And the money, we went into the construction of the project, and it's in construction right now. And we're now going to spin it out to four different schools. And we're talking with FIFA for maybe implementing this project in Brazil as well. And so what it's doing is bringing, and the coaches of the girls' team are also trained HIV/AIDS nurses and doctors. And they'll start with education and eventually do antiretroviral rollout. So it's, attached to it, it ties in. I asked a simple question, and we're working in an area where there's 56% HIV/AIDS rate of women. I said, what happens once we keep these girls alive? And everyone was like, no one could answer that question. I said, well, once you drop the rate of HIV/AIDS, more women are going to be alive. So then what do they do? So we actually integrated a technology center so we can do skills training on site, and so that there's job generation. And starting businesses from that, so yeah, it's under construction.
We'll keep the bathroom in the schools first.
A
bit general question. Since you've opened up this network, have you noticed any interesting trends that have been picking up in any area? I'm just there. Any surprises, and what are the challenges you've encountered, on a negative basis?
Surprises has been people who have been adopting it that I didn't think would adopt it. Where it's somebody who's not even an architect who has like crawled out of whatever like small cob house they've been in, and they have 30 years of knowledge, and all they want to do is give it away. And they're just like, this is perfect. You know, you can build with, Iowa could become a cob nation, right? And they're just telling, and I love it, like the crackpots of the world, right? And I used to get this on my email, a 40 megabyte
now
file.
Now the whole world can see it, yeah.
Right. No. And then on the negative side, there's certainly been, detractors, which is, I mean, even from a high level, which is like, well, if you're sharing ideas, you know, isn't that going to cut into kind of the star architecture kind of, you know, mandate of like, we have these 10 celebrities and then underneath you have like the, and it's changing the way that we do business. So it's kind of like saying, you can have a young designer who's 20 years old who connected with a licensed architect can get a building built, and they're not working as a slave in the model shop for 40 years. So I've had some negative feedback from like, oh, you know, I spent 20 years working. You know, now so it's kind of like, you know.
He does have slaves in his architecture shop,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah.
Just to let you know.
Yeah, but they're yeah.
Do you publish a list of your projects and your wish list and what it costs, what it will cost to produce those projects?
Not yet, but we need to.
Your question.
You know the most interesting connection? Voice of America. The most liberal students who are desperate for a job end up working as reporters for Voice of America, which is in 129 countries. And you can literally go on that and call up any of them, and they'll put you on for half an hour and then translate it into every dialect. We'll use everything from blogs to radio to, and then visit. We have a lot of, like I say, our architects are in 104 countries. So although I can't meet that rural community, you know, oh, another surprise, sorry, I just remembered.
Yep.
Professor that I was showing the architecture network to in Muncie, Indiana, and we went live and we went on there, and he saw the users. And there's on average about a dozen users and about 4,000 visitors at any one time. So I don't know what that means in web terms, but
registered
it's a lot.
Users is what it means.
Yeah. Well, you can email me, it's right there. It's cameron@architectsforhumanity.org, that's the easiest. Or you can go to Architects for Humanity if you're looking for help, or go to the Open Architecture Network and start a project. Just say you're looking for...
And if it's technology related, you can go to...
What? Oh, okay, I'll just end the story. So we went online for the first time ever, and we logged on, I logged him on, and he looked at the side of the users, and he saw a name that was, I couldn't pronounce it. But he's like, I think that's a former student of mine. And he clicked on it. It turns out that it was a Nepalese exchange student he had like 5 years ago. And he was using it to build libraries in Nepal. And so he started emailing with him through the network, just like that. So it's kind of funny. I could, like, proof of concept. I was like, you see? You know, like, people are...
But in answer to your question, if there's a technology element as well, if you just go to www.50x15.com, you actually can literally sign up and say you're interested in having a deployment done.
Oh, and then the RFP.
And becomes part of the process. And I was going to talk about the RFP process. The RFP process for the challenge was one of the most interesting things that we've encountered, because we actually wanted to try to get the RFP. This is for people who would maintain these dwellings or these structures that we described. We wanted to get the RFP to people who didn't have internet access, right? Because the whole idea is we're going to try to generate internet in other places. And it was a significant challenge for us to get it into multiple languages and get it to multiple places. But it's surprising how many people or how many submissions have started coming in from places that we never heard of. So it's been extraordinary.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm around. And I'll be in Australia next year. So, and you should find a guy called Paul Falaris, who very Australian. He has a project called Keep the Water In, Keep the Shit Out. and he works on the Aboriginal communities on repairing rural communities. It's really a fascinating project. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And if you're interested in Biloxi and the Gulf Coast, I think on 7:45 on Thursday morning, Kate, my better half, will be speaking, and she'll be much more succinct than I am. So.
She has to be. She always does.